Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 118th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and on this episode, we are doing another Matt and Oren episode. We just have so much to catch up on. We have a lot of questions from listeners that we really wanted to address, and we thought, hey, let's do a whole episode where it's just our voices.
You just guys Q and an A in. Just Q&A in. So if you wrote us a question in the recent past, this is the day that we probably are answering it. So strap in. It's a lot of great questions. We're covering topics like web series versus short film, what to do if you're spending a summer in Los Angeles, how to promote yourself at film festivals, all sorts of great stuff. But before we talk about that, this episode was brought to you by our patrons, Jordan, Matt, Evelyn, Dempsey, Ryan, Jonathan, David, Artemis, Luke, Nathan, and Nathan. Look at that. What a great list of people. We have a Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can contribute to the show. And it helps us grow. It helps us pay our editors, which is the main thing, because they do a lot of hard work and it's thankless. And we really appreciate it. So we're going to keep the show for free, like we always do. But we're trying to figure out some cool incentives that'll kind of stay within the spirit of the show, keeping things free, keeping things all access for all people, but also still giving people who are throwing in a little bit of cash something special. So stay tuned for that and more live events, which is the other thing that we're working on. We got some cool stuff in the works. Can't wait to talk about it.
Let's vow right now that we're going to have another live event before school starts.
Oh, definitely.
Before September.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
There's only 2 months left, so we better
Producer
get on
Madeline
it.
Is like, oh no.
Yeah, we keep promising people things that are impossible.
We're going to make it happen.
Cool. Well, thank you to our patrons. Before we get into the listener questions, I was curious, Matt, what have you been working on lately?
So I had a great day in Beverly Hills, actually. I am in the process of finding a new lawyer. So I hope that my current one, doesn't listen to the show.
Yeah.
I don't think he does.
Me too.
But just in case, he was really great. But also, I think we're just kind of diverging paths a little bit. And so I did a different version of the water bottle tour today, where I went around to all the fancy law firms. It was just two. You know, it's kind of like going to an agency or a manager or something like that, but they're lawyers instead. But, you know, I didn't realize this until I had a lawyer, that entertainment lawyers represent you in the same way that agents do, in that they have a roster, they have clients, and they're on retainer. So you're not paying them an hourly, typically. Sometimes people will do that. If you're like making a feature or something like that, you'll have to have a different sort of lawyer that you pay by the hour. But for the most part, they are doing the work of negotiating your deals. And as a result, when you're a younger client, a newer client, they know that you're not going to be bringing in the big bucks the way some of their more senior clients are or experienced clients are. But so it's kind of an investment in a person. And so in the same way that you get an agent or a manager, you have to have a, you know, a, your lawyer is a part of your team, quote unquote.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of our listeners will be like, will think that the lawyer is probably the last person that you would need. And you probably only need them if you are negotiating some contract, right?
Yeah, that's what it feels like. But, you know, it's funny, depending on the way that your team is comprised and the personalities therein, some agents and managers are really good at deals and really capable of kind of figuring out all of the different aspects of a career and of a deal memo and can kind of really like hash things out and then pass it off to a lawyer and the lawyer can kind of just button everything up. Those agents and managers who are very good and thorough at that tend to have been lawyers once upon a time. There are also people who are very artsy-fartsy and, you know, let the lawyer do the lion's share of the negotiating and work. And there's kind of part of the way that you figure out whether or not your team is right for each other is kind of in figuring out that aspect of it. So I know that there are some lawyers out there that will kind of have a two-tiered system, actually. So if you have a team, then they'll only take 5%. But if they are the sole negotiating party for you, if you don't have an agent and manager, they'll take a little bit more. They'll do like 10%, which is an interesting thing that I hadn't heard before. But makes complete sense because, like, you know, it's entertainment lawyers. So they're not just lawyers. They're like Hollywood people.
Right. And there's that's still less money. If you have an agent and or like I have a manager and a lawyer. And so together they take 15%.
Yeah.
10% to the manager, 5% to the lawyer. Right.
Yeah, yeah. 25% of my checks are going to other people. It's hella cool.
Yeah. So you got to work extra hard to make less money so that you have to pay them less.
Yeah. Yeah. The nice thing is that all of those people are certainly much better at negotiating than I am. I always joke. I'm like, I would do it for free. And they're like, no, no, no. So in every instance where I've brought in a third party to do any sort of negotiation, they have paid for themselves.
Yeah.
Like I know what that initial offer is, and then they make things much better for me.
It's also like pretty baller to have a lawyer.
Man, I'll tell you what. I will admit I felt a little inferior, you know? Like I think that it's been a while since I've been like, oh, am I a fraud? You know, like you're in these fancy places and everybody's like super duper smart, like they're great lawyers and also they're like well-dressed and like good looking and like slick and smart and really knowledgeable and passionate about the thing that you're passionate about. So it's like they're intimidating cool people, you know, and then you're also in like the corner office and there's the fancy paintings on the wall and stuff. And it's just like, oh, I'm in Hollywood right now. In a way that I hadn't been.
They're not that great. They're still
some
lawyers.
Great people today. Yeah, they are still lawyers. Yeah, that's true. But they're lawyers that go to Sundance every year, or Just for Laughs, or you know South by.
Right.
I think it's funny because my wife's family, they're a bunch of lawyers, and most of her childhood friends became lawyers. So like we basically only know lawyers and entertainment people, but they are. You're kind of more standard, like, lawyers.
Right.
And so to be around entertainment lawyers is just like a different experience.
Yeah, basically. It's a lawyer that you actually have something to talk to about.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to regular lawyers are like, yeah, you know, I'm doing workman's comp.
Yeah, sure. I'm preparing for a deposition.
Yeah. Yeah, my lawyer actually got me my first manager's or my second manager's. Yeah, so they can do that. They can introduce you too.
Yeah.
But like, just... Cut into the chase. What do our listeners care to know about lawyers? Like, let's say Michaela just graduated film school. She moved to LA. She wants to be a director. Does she need a lawyer?
I think that Michaela, who's just moved to LA and wonders if she needs a lawyer, I think that the answer is like with an agent or manager, not until you need one. You know, I think that if you... happen to have if you meet one at a party and you like you hit it off and like there's the opportunity to maybe do some business together, sure, like, you know, if it's a match made in heaven, go for it. But typically I didn't get my first entertainment lawyer until my first show, basically, where like I needed one, and then you kind of ask around and you get referred to someone, basically.
Right.
But the thing that I didn't know then and I just kind of lucked into, is that their relationships are part of the value that they bring. And so being at a represented at a company brings with it the introductions and things, you know, like with an agency. So like when you're picking who you're going to be repped by, knowing their roster, which you can look up on IMDb Pro, just like you can any other agency or a representative. But like that's part of it, you know. So like I keep thinking of Maureen Barucha. You know, her break with getting on Kimmel came through her lawyer.
Right.
Certainly, all of my other previous lawyers have been really great and had that those connections as well. And like when their clients are asking around, they're asking their lawyers, oh, hey, who's good for this style of job? So if you're the only comedy person in a firm filled with, you know, CSI showrunners, then, you know, maybe that's great and maybe that's not such a good fit. And so there's a little bit of that question mark as well.
Yeah. So enough about how great lawyers are. They are great. Let me I think what maybe our listeners might be asking, and this is something I've kind of come up with a lot and have gotten questions about a lot, is like how big does a project need to be for you to engage a lawyer? Because I've had people email me like, hey, can you refer me to like an entertainment lawyer? I just got a deal to do this web series. And then I usually go like, well, so what's, if you don't mind me asking, what's the budget of the web series? And if they say like $10,000 all in for that everything, I don't think you should talk, like, I'm not going to refer you to my lawyer. He'll be mad at me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He'll be like, why are you wasting my time?
Yeah. What's the threshold to the talk threshold, to the lawyer?
To me, the threshold is when you have created something where it has value and a company has decided to purchase or license or option that.
Right. But what project. If the company says, hey, we're going to give you 10 grand to go make these 5 3-minute episodes of your show.
Mm-hmm. That's tricky. That is the perfect case where it really comes down to how valuable you think that IP actually is. So for instance, you know, I tend to not bring lawyers in on work for hire jobs. So anything where I had been I'm a gun for hire, no matter what the scale is, I tend to not worry about it too much because, like, I know I'm not going to ever get a piece of...
The ownership.
For the perfect example is, like, those Ellen jobs I did, those branded pieces I did for Ellen, it would be a waste of everyone's time for them to come through that 20-page document when I know for sure... the giant machine that is Ellen is just going to own everything.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it would just be a waste of... It would be annoying for everyone. And then I'd owe them 5% on top of that. So it's totally different when you're the person creating all of that work, basically.
Right.
So if I had gone in and pitched something, even if the sale was small, I think I would talk to them about it, and I would be upfront and be like, listen, this is a small thing, blah, blah, blah. But their whole job is to protect you from the fortunate future. So like if you're like, I've got this great web series idea, and then, you know, a couple years down the line, it becomes a giant phenomenon and they're not making that 5% off of like the huge thing that you made. That's a mistake for everybody. You know, and frankly is counterproductive to the whole thing of developing clients.
I think as a general rule, like with commercials, you would never really engage a lawyer, right? Unless for some reason it's like based around something, an idea that you came up with.
Right.
And you own. But yeah, to me, I like if my lawyer is going to make less than $1,000 off of a project, so... If the budget is under $1,000, is 5% of what? Of $20,000?
$20,000, yeah.
Yeah. So if I'm making less than that, then I'm probably not going to involve my lawyer unless it's like a shopping agreement or a pitch or something that I like really created and I'm trying to sell to a big network that has money, right? Or a big studio or a big company. But yeah, I think, I don't know. I guess if you're working on the $10,000 budget thing, then I would say leave the lawyers out, right?
Yeah, probably. I think I think it's worth it to just talk to them about it real quick. Oh, it's so tricky, right?
Because, right, well, like, no, but if you don't have a lawyer, if you have a lawyer, sure, you can tap them for those.
I think it's that tricky thing of, like, you know, of course everyone hopes that their web series idea is going to evolve into something that makes millions and millions of dollars, and then, you know, they want to make sure that they're protected. So it's a bit of a back and forth.
Right. I'm working with a friend on this project for, well, we're just kind of pitching it to Crypt TV. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they make these kind of super low budget, like horror concept series and videos, and they accept submissions from the public. So you can go to their website and you can type an idea and submit it to them. And they're make you sign a zillion things saying that they basically own every single thing that you wrote. And they're doing it to protect themselves, because if you say, oh, it's a scary clown, and then next week they put something out that's about a scary clown, they don't want you to try to sue them because you think it's your idea. And my friend and I, that we're working on this thing together, are like, we would never show our lawyers this thing that we're signing, because they would never in a million years approve it. But but we would also never do anything,
right?
If our lawyers, like, had to approve every single move we made.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, enough about lawyers.
Oren, tell me, what have you been working on lately?
Well, just real quick, I've been I'm pitching on another commercial campaign, which is fun. It's going to shoot out of LA. So, you know, our last
episode. Can you share with us where?
Yeah, it's supposed to shoot in outside of Phoenix. It's for Nissan. It would be shoot at their test facility. I'm pitching on that. So that's, you know, your regular thing. I kind of was thinking today about how all my commercial pitches are pretty much the same thing. I actually just sent Madeline some of my treatments. And it's like, here's the concept, here's the tone, here's what I think about casting, performances, look, style, camera work, visual effects, whatever. I basically, like, go down the call sheet and answer, like, how I would shoot every single part of it. Then I go into the specific script of the project. And I was wondering, like, is that going to get stale, like, in a few months? Like, when everyone is just, like, writing the same looking treatments? Because I'm submitting it and two other directors are submitting their treatments, and I don't know what even makes our treatments different from each other. We're probably all Googling the same Google images.
I think that's why the images that you pick are so important, because everyone's kind of saying the same thing, right? It's like, we're going to pick the best actors, and, like, the camera's going to look great, and here's how it's going to look great, and we're going to have a great time. But, like, those style choices, really showing people, not telling them, I think is why, that's how those treatments all stay so fresh, you know?
Yeah, but I think everyone is, you know, when the agency gives you the script, a lot of times they give you images with them. So they're kind of already sending you on a tone. And this campaign is like a splinter campaign from, like, a bigger Nissan campaign. So I already know the tone. Like, I just feel like everyone is going to give the same thing. And so I'm trying to really stay simple and find, like, one concept that I really connect with from the creative. So this specific one is these kind of, like, really funny characters in these Nissans that are being tested, like, at a test facility. And so it's kind of all about the juxtaposition between these crazy characters and the science behind these vehicles. And I'm just trying to, like, make every page be about the juxtaposition. Like, how can we make the performance support that? How can we make the visual support that? How can we make the pacing and the casting and all that stuff support the juxtaposition of this really these really silly characters in this really serious setting, you know? And I think that's going to be my strategy for this treatment, is, like, here's one idea, like, you know, the juxtaposing really funny things with really serious things. And how do I, like, blow that out in every aspect of, like, the filmmaking, right? In terms of the locations, the casting, the colors, everything. So we'll see. And I think, you know, I don't know, Jordan Brady would tell us, like, it's one idea, you know? Like, that's what wins a commercial campaign.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I think in the last campaign, the Comcast campaign, I got, one of the reasons I got it is because the creative, like, it didn't feel very cohesive. There were all these social spots and these kind of more TV style spots that felt so different from each other that I couldn't figure out how they work together, that I just ended up writing two different treatments. And they said, like, on the call, they're like, hey, we love that you separated these out into two separate things.
Oh, cool.
And then once I did the job, they told me we were actually trying to hire two different directors.
Oh, interesting.
And we ended up finding you, and because we were looking for someone that could, that had that range, which, you know, you never sure. want to say, like, I can do everything, but on this specific job, I got it because it was like a one-stop solution for
and for sure, crazy every characters. Other director that was up against you on those spots probably has that range as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. There are the directors that really push themselves on comedy, really on lifestyle, really on beauty or effects or whatever, so...
Yeah, that's true. Like, lifestyle versus comedy is a pretty hard jump to make.
Yeah, and that was exactly the jump that had to happen here. So, anyway, I ran into one of the actors from my commercial at dinner today at the restaurant. Does that happen to you ever? Like, you met someone in an audition, and then you see them somewhere in public, like in the real world?
That doesn't happen too often, but I do remember just the other day, my wife was... auditioning and telling me about it afterwards, and she was describing this person who was also an actor waiting to audition for a different role, and I was like, I know that guy, and like pulled up the spot and showed her, and I was like, it wasn't him, and it was a guy that I had cast before, and she was like, yes. So
yeah, it is part of the interesting thing of living in LA. I saw this actor at the Apple store, and I was like, I really wanted to cast him, but the agency chose someone else for something else. And I was like, hey, man, remember I auditioned you? And he's like, yeah, kind of. I go to a lot of auditions. I'm like, well, I really wanted to cast you, but the agency wanted someone else. He's like, okay, cool. Thanks, man.
Dude,
I was like, maybe I shouldn't have told him that. Maybe that was just weird.
I remember doing a spot like a year or two ago where one of the actors that came in is a barista at my coffee shop.
Oh, that's awkward.
Like so close, and there's only a handful of people who pour coffee there, and I'm there most of the time. Like, I'm there, like, multiple days a week, and, like, a lot of our peers are there.
Right, now you have to go to a new coffee shop.
Well, I was like, wait a minute, you're my barista, and we talked about it for a minute, and then, like, it was a guy, I wanted to cast him, and then the agency went a different direction, and I never talked to him about it, and it's been awkward for like 2 years.
You should. That was going to be my last question.
I should have told him like that I wanted to cast
him. No, you should tell him next time you see him.
Yeah.
Just say, hey, I was just talking to my actor friends yesterday about this, and they said that it's always better to know than to not know. Because my wife is on this improv team, and a lot of the people on her team like audition for me sometimes, and they'll just ask me, like, hey, what's your feedback? Like, why didn't I get the part? And then I tell them, and they're like, thank you so much. Like, you have no idea how valuable that is.
Yeah, totally.
To know that I was close, to know that this, and like, so I don't know. I try to tell actors if I see them in public, especially if they didn't get the part, like, hey, you were great. They ended up doing this, but, you know, hopefully we'll see you again. Like, I don't know. I just don't like sad actors. So I try to make them happy.
Totally.
So the other thing I did this past week, real quick, is I had a meeting. Someone had sent me a proof of concept. Well, they'd sent my manager a proof of concept, and he sent it to me. Thought it was like a good fit for me, maybe. And I am going to go pitch like a feature based on this concept. Mm-hmm. So I feel like this is something that I feel like used to happen a lot, where people would say, like, hey, here's a book, or here's some sort of
what's your take
idea.
On this?
Yeah, what's your take on it? They would meet with different directors, and they'd be like, well, I picture it as a thriller, and this and this and this. Have you ever done that? Have you ever pitched, like, your take?
My take?
On something?
I've only pitched takes on...
like on a script?
Finished scripts. Yeah. So I don't think I've ever been, like, sent a book or a comic. You know, I had the chance to pitch a couple. You know what? I take it back. I will get the opportunity where someone will represent a library. So, like, Warner Brothers is like, we own all the entire Hanna-Barbera library.
Right. Or you Disney. Know, do you want to reinvent? With Disney characters.
Yeah.
Just exactly. Don't use their names.
Right. Yeah. And inevitably, those lists are always like super cool. And then you're like, what? James Bond is on this list? And they're like, yeah, that one. That
right. You can't touch James Bond or Star Wars or Hannah Montana.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I've got a great Hannah Montana take, though.
Oh, cool. I actually shot a pilot presentation based on this guy that had all the rights to America's Funniest Home Videos, Vin DeBono. The premise was like this guy that worked for America's Funniest Home Videos, and he'd like watched so many videos of people getting kicked in the nuts or whatever,
right,
that every time like he kept connecting them to these different things in his life. So he would have his own personal experiences and he would kind of have flashbacks of videos he saw of these crazy things. Mostly people getting hit in the nuts.
Also, Bob Saget like kind of does funny voices.
Yeah, or Tom Bergeron or whoever the current one.
Down the street, don't know what's going to happen.
Right. So we would cut to those things, but I don't know. It's always weird when you're like cutting to clips of like old stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
Anyhow, so we'll see. I'm supposed to. I have no idea what my take is. I've had a bunch of ideas, and my manager's like, just treat it like a commercial, just like write a commercial treatment. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so that's like a 30 page document. He's like, no, just like write a few pages.
Nah, man, I think go for it. Because I think when you say 30 page document, he thinks 30 pages of text, which no one will read.
Right.
But like a super slick 30 page deck.
That would just take me like hella sexy. To do.
Hey, man, do you want a movie or not?
I don't know. I want a movie, but I kind of want my movie more than my take on someone else's movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's it. Let's get to some listener questions.
Love it. Let's get to it. Our first question is from Colette Robichaud. She writes, "Hey, Matt and Oren, I'm an aspiring filmmaker currently living in New York, and I'm wrapping up post on my first short film. Congrats. I'm really happy with how the short is coming together, and I have a script and a plan for another short, a semi-dystopian black comedy murder mystery that I want to shoot this August." So then she talks a little bit about how she's trying to make the most of this final year in New York. She's got this really great idea for a movie that's kind of like Good Time meets Grimm Brothers. That's going to be really cool. The thing is that it's really ambitious. And so it doesn't really make sense to do something shorter than 15 minutes, which is what she's heard is kind of the sweet spot for a short film. She could do it as a 5-episode digital series with 5 to 10 minute episodes. Or she could condense it into a single short that would be longer than 30 minutes, basically. So she's trying to figure that out. And she doesn't totally think that she has the resources to turn it into like a 75-minute feature. And so her question is from an audience and portfolio building standpoint, do you think I would be better served making a 5-part digital series or a single short film?
Not knowing too much, my instinct is to do the 15-minute short. because 5 episodes of a digital show, I just can't think of any successful 5-episode digital show in history that has like kind of launched someone's career than like a 15-minute short. What do you think? Am I being crazy? I
mean, she's saying she wants to do the short should be longer than 15 minutes. She said that she could condense it in the story into a single short film that's 30 minutes long.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
That's the tricky part. Yeah. So if she could do it in under 15, then that would be the easy answer, right? But because it sounds like she really loves this concept and it does sound pretty cool, she's really at a crossroads. I will say the obvious example of a short season web series that did do great is High Maintenance. High Maintenance first season was not very many episodes.
But it was more than 5 episodes, right?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, really?
Maybe it was 6, but like they were short. It was like an early...
And it's an anthology series, right? So they all kind of stand alone.
Yeah, totally. It was a different time. It's hard to compare the differences.
I guess to me, like, look, we've all had this problem where we're like, we want to make this short and then... You basically have an idea for a feature and you're trying to figure out how to make a short out of it. And a short is just different than a feature film and it's different than a 1-hour pilot, right?
Yeah. So you know what? I figured it out. Here's my advice actually for Colette. Colette, I would say, because this email makes it me think that you are very passionate about this project and it sounds genuinely super cool. So first off, kudos, go get it. It's going to be awesome. I think what you should do is write a awesome full-length feature version of this story and also have a nice, tight, proof-of-concept style short that is under 15 minutes, like a 10-minute slice of that story. Basically, pull a Whiplash is what I'm suggesting that you do.
Yeah, and so, she has a high concept that kind of requires her to shoot from October through May, right? Because these seasons are going to be passing over the course of her short film. I actually think the shorter the film is, the more impressive
the that cooler is. It is. Yeah. So I think...
So maybe you can pare down your story or make it the setup or make it the kind of start at the end of what would be the second act in your feature. Or even find different characters that work through that concept with a shorter story. Because that is a really cool concept. It's like Boyhood, but based on seasons, right?
Yeah. And with like a kind of cool fairy tale aspect to it as well. So yeah, I think you're right. Just I drown some darlings and really find that like really like 10-minute kick-ass short. But then also be ready with the fully realized script so that when... it becomes that Vimeo staff pick and it plays South by Southwest and everyone's like, oh my God, this is such a cool idea. I can't believe it. You're like, yeah, it is. Here's the feature screenplay. So yeah, I feel Colette, let us know how it goes. That's going to be awesome. I can't wait to see your movie. Next up, we have a voicemail from Alyssa Racine. I love the voicemails.
Hi guys. This is Alyssa Racine. I listened to your podcast. My son is at film school and he just moved to Los Angeles. So he just moved out there and it's a summer schedule and he's looking to kind of fill up his time because it's got, the schedule is kind of on a summer program. So it's a little loose. He's studying acting for film. So I didn't know. I listen to you guys all the time and you have great suggestions. That's how I picked where he lived. So I was hoping maybe you had some ideas for maybe some kind of work he could get, like just, you know, working for free or anything like that. I would love to hear back from you. Thank you.
Just to summarize, Alyssa is asking, basically her son is out here in Los Angeles for the summer. He's interning and, you know, doing the LA thing. And so the general question is just like, how do you make the most of a summer in Los Angeles? Oren, you went to school at UCLA, so you never had to do the summer programs or anything like that.
No, but I mean, I moved to LA and tried to figure it out. It's kind of like the same thing.
Kind of the same thing. I think there is a distinct difference, though, in that you know you're going to leave at the end of the summer when you're doing those programs. I know Emerson is really good at doing that. Like they really ship people out and like are really good at placing people. I know there's a lot of schools that are doing like the summer in LA programs.
Right.
Which I thoroughly recommend. I think it's a really cool thing for people.
Yeah. Well, so my friend Sarah is actually the alumni coordinator for Columbia College Chicago. Mm-hmm. And she is based in LA and she helps people find jobs and internships and free work. So, if Alyssa's son is in film school in LA, I highly recommend he, ask the film school what kind of work they can hook him up with. I mean, I know he's studying acting for film, so it's a whole different ball game, you know, acting versus crew work, but it sounds like he is just interested in getting on sets in any way possible. So, you know, I mean, we say this a million times every episode, but just like, meet the people in your film school program and just go make stuff with them and you will meet other people, right? Like you'll end up hiring some crew people, you know, to work on your shorts and they will in turn hire you when they're working on something else.
I just got so nostalgic at the thought of Alyssa's son, like spending a summer in Los Angeles and crewing around with a bunch of new friends. That's the summer of your life. That's like the best summer ever.
Yeah. And of course, there's Mandy.com and productionjobs.com and Craigslist and all these places you can find jobs. Facebook. I would literally befriend all the people that you can at your film school on Facebook and write, hey, you know, I'm looking for on-set experience. If anyone needs a PA, let me know.
I'm going to say don't spam strangers because they go to the same film school as you.
Well, not strangers, people in your class. Like you add them as friends. Yeah. And then you don't send them a message. You post it on your own thing.
Once you know someone, definitely like friend them. But yeah. Yeah, I would encourage you friend people once you've met them in real life. So my main thought actually is really lean into the alumni association or the people who are helping to create this environment for you. Oftentimes they'll have mixers and panels and screenings and all that stuff. Go to all that stuff. And that's where you will meet all of the people who are doing the exact same thing as you. And I think that'll be that's your best shot at making like meaningful friendships, and then you can all go crew together and work on that stuff. So if you are a part of a program that doesn't have quite a robust of an infrastructure, you know, if your school is still kind of like emerging and deciding whether or not they want to be investing, because it is a lot of work and a lot of resources to make a basically what's an abroad program in LA. Oren, do you have any suggestions for those people if you don't have a lot of peers out there?
Yeah, same exact suggestions we just gave. Go to Craigslist, go to Mandy.com, go to La Poubelle on Franklin and meet people, go to UCB.
Oh, I think that's old man advice. La Poubelle is for the people who go to UCB who are in their 30s. Birds is for when you're in 20s. Yeah.
These are two bars right on either side of the UCB theater on Franklin.
So I lived walking distance, and we would go to UCB all the time. That was like where our first new batch of friends were created. My wife was in an improv team, and so we would hang out. And I would go to Birds twice a week probably for like 2 or 3 years, and I did not set foot in the other bar on the other side of the theater until I was 30.
Okay. Yeah, it is a little bit of a more mature vibe over there.
It is, which, you know, now it's great.
But I will say, Alyssa, I love that you listen to our podcast. Please tell your son to listen to our podcast.
And he's for him LA. To tell all of his friends.
Yeah. And also, I think, not to be too presumptuous or jerky, I think this is a thing that a lot of parents whose kids like want to go to LA to make it in the film business are worried about. That they won't find a job, that they've heard it's like so hard. But like, if you build a network, and especially if you're not like looking to get rich immediately, that's what you move to LA for. Your son will meet people, especially if he's an actor. He will find his community and he'll get work. It's really easy to get work, especially if you're willing to work for free.
100%. Your kid is going to do great, Alyssa. Your son is going to be fine. It's not easy to book acting work necessarily. That I don't want to belittle.
Oh, right. No.
The anxieties of like how intimidating. It's reasonable that it's intimidating.
You're not going to get Stranger Things the day you get off the bus here, but you can be in shorts. You can make your own shorts. You can do some.
Yeah, just be friendly. Pay attention. And be in the building, basically. That's really what it boils down to. Like, that's the other part of it. It's just being around, then opportunities just kind of come up. And if you're game and smart and hardworking and pay attention, then people will notice.
I mean, look, part of the requirements of working in film in LA is to meet people and socialize with them. And if that's not your cup of tea, then this might not be the business for you. But if you enjoy collaborating and talking to people and being curious about things, you will meet people that have things going on. And if especially you're not trying to be on NBC, you know, immediately or like in giant studio films, if you're just open to making things no matter what, then you will find things to make in LA. Guaranteed.
Go get it. Awesome. So the next question comes from Kevin. He's got a film playing at a local film festival, Dances with Films, and he wanted to let us know, that he's got a screening that we have since missed, unfortunately, but congratulations anyway, Kevin. And he was trying basically to figure out other ways in which he could promote his film while it's at a Los Angeles Film Festival. Like, how can he kind of get the word out, basically, about his film? So... you know, of course, we're doing all of the standard things of like, you go ahead and you print up a couple posters, you've got your postcards ready, you've got your business cards, and maybe you've, you know, sprung for something extra expensive and got like novelty sunglasses or like, you know, little toys or something that relates to your film. You know, you kind of got all of the merch and it's all over those tables at the every film festival you've ever been to. And there's a poster in every coffee shop. What else can Kevin be doing to make sure that his movie makes as big a splash as possible?
Well, first of all, he can email a podcast and ask a question about it, which is why we're going to plug his movie right now. It's called At the End of the Day, and his website is endofthedayfilm.com. So check it out if you want to see what kind of people listen to our podcast. So I do think, like, basically the reason we got this question is because Kevin was, like, emailing every person he could think of to invite them to the screening, and I think... The interesting question he asks is, like, is there a type of person that is helpful to have at your screening? I mean, he called them influencers, but basically, like, so either celebrities or people with, like, a big social reach that if they like your movie can say something positive about it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like influencer 101. But have you found that method to be... Have you done that before? Have you tried to invite influential people to your screenings in order to create buzz?
Yeah, so, you know, I have done a different version of it, but when I was doing Squaresville, we would stunt cast people, especially like fun, like smaller roles where I knew it was just going to be, you know, an hour or two of somebody's time. Mystery Guitar Man is in Squaresville. Jimmy Wong is in Squaresville. I'm trying to think of other people. But yeah, there were definitely, like, we would have kind of small roles basically given to people because it would be fun and
apropos. Right, but that's a totally different type of
But then publicity. The other thing we would do is we would do videos where we would ask those other influencers to, like, submit questions basically, so we would cross promote those people. And that's not exactly what Kevin's asking for, but, like, the point is like, yeah, like there is kind of like a quid pro quo in terms of cross promoting people. The tricky thing is that, like, you need to basically be on equitable footing with the entity that you're engaging with in terms of that cross promotion. So if you are like, hey, we'll promote you guys, and I've got 200 Twitter followers, and somebody else has got a bazillion, unless they connect personally with your film in some way, they're probably not going to be falling over themselves to promote your film. Right. So there's a couple things you can do, right? Like, you can appeal to their, like, either you know them personally, right? Or you have a friend who knows them personally, in which case, like, a little bit of Google stalking will get you there. Or you can do a good job of appealing to their causes. Right, so if your film is about a specific topic that you know is apropos or important to that influencer, that would be a thing that you could do as
right. Like Kevin's movie is specific to LGBTQ homeless youth.
Right.
Right. And so, kind of crossed with Christian, you know, religious people and like right. where those worlds intersect.
So basically the question that Kevin or any filmmaker needs to ask themselves is who would like my movie? And then that's your psychographic, that's your group, your potential fans. And then who do they like? Like, who do those people watch on YouTube? Who do those people follow on Instagram? And then you've got a value offer to those people, to those influencers. You can say, hey, listen, I think your audience is really going to respond to my film. How can we work together?
Right.
Easier said than done. That's like, you know, people make millions of dollars off of influencers promoting movies and things like that. So, you know, it's a tough road to follow.
Yeah, but also even just getting way more specific to Kevin's question, which is like, who should I invite to my screening? I think, like, I mean, he invited us and we are not very famous, or we are not necessarily big influencers, but even for us, it's like we have families, we have things to do, we have set, like, if we're not going to show up, why is like Logan Paul going to go show up, you know, unless he's like best friends with this person. So I think all the things you're saying is like, let's see what we can do online or offer things up to them to promote our movie that are very easy for them. Mm-hmm. Showing up to a screening is not very easy. I had, when my feature premiered at AFI, which was like right in the heart of LA, very close to where a million actors live, like I had just worked with Alison Brie at the time, and I was like, hey, you should come to the screening. And I, you know, my friend Mo Mandel was on a TV show at the time, and I was like, you should come. And all these people, my friend Carter was on a TV show, and I was like, you guys should all come. And I was telling the PR people, like, let's get photographers and let's get all this stuff. But it was like Wednesday at 7 p.m. or whatever, and they were like, I can't make it. Sorry. And these were like my friends, you know, people I'd worked with and I knew, and I wasn't like cold emailing. So I think, you know, if personally, I think the screening is for you to just have like an awesome time and meet new people. And like the amount of press and buzz you can build around your movie, there's better outlets than inviting specific people to your screen. You should invite everyone, but just don't expect anything. You know, don't make that a major pillar of like your PR move to promote your project. That's my personal feeling from my personal experience. I could be totally wrong, but I've always had way more luck with social media influencers through social media as opposed to like trying to get them to physically be at a place.
Yeah. I think
unless I'm paying them a ton of money.
No, sure, fair enough. And even still, it's pretty hard. I would say, like, if Kevin had gotten, you know, someone famous to come to his screening, I think, honestly, it would mostly help the festival that would then have a photo of that person in front of their step and repeat on their website forever.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, if I had the option of... So, my movie was about... It was UFC-related. If I could have... like a famous UFC fighter, like Ronda Rousey, come to my screening or tweet about the movie. If I had to choose one of them, I would choose the tweet, you know, a million times over.
Right. Well, and I think also ideally Ronda Rousey is tweeting about your film with a link to iTunes or something like that. Like making it something where your potential fan base or your future fan base can also access your film. Is the other thing. So like only so many people can go to a screening of a film festival, right? They're limited by geography. They're limited by schedule. They're limited by total number of seats in the theater. And so I think you're right, Oren, of just like have a good time at the festival, invite your friends and family. And look, if it's a festival where their ability to amplify, say, your film or the stars, you know, their credibility, the credibility of the festival helps those people's careers. They're going to show up. Do you know what I mean? Like you don't have to ask too hard for your star to show up to South by Southwest. And that's because your star knows that being in a movie that's at South by is valuable to their career. So that's where, again, that trade-off of like it being you're on equitable footing then because you're giving them the credibility of this film festival to help promote themselves.
Right. Cool. Well, congrats on the movie.
Yeah, way to go, Kevin.
Cool. Well, let's go on to our next question from Keith. He says, hey, I'm listening to your podcast as I drive from Chicago to L.A. I've worked as a union prop set dresser in Chicago for 10 plus years, but want to work on my own writing and directing projects while I'm in L.A. What advice do you have as far as neighborhoods to move to and how to network with aspiring writers and directors as opposed to the art department folks do you have, Keith? So... Congrats, Keith, on moving to LA.
Yeah.
And from Chicago, I feel like that's like you're already in a great film town of Chicago. And
he's
theater,
in the union. Yeah.
And though I am sure I could be wrong about this, but I do believe it's separate unions in Chicago and LA.
Oh, interesting.
Mm. I know New York and LA are different unions.
Yeah, interesting.
I think you can transfer membership, but...
At the very least, I think that on your resume will help you... start booking work pretty quick.
Yeah, clearly you know what you're doing, being a union set dresser for 10 plus years. So yeah, I mean, my number one piece of advice is listen to our Moving to LA episode because we talk at length about which neighborhoods we think you should live in. And by the way, we have gotten some pushback from our friends in Marina Del Rey.
Oh, that's funny. I couldn't hear them because they're 30 miles away. Sorry. Just kidding. Plenty of people live in Marina Boat.
No, Marina Del Rey is beautiful. It's a little far away and not the most affordable of neighborhoods.
Sure. Yeah.
But
I will say, actually, now that I think of it, some of the most successful people I know live in Marina Del Rey.
Yeah, Marina Del Rey you live in after you've kind of built your network.
Yeah.
And are trying to get a little bit of peace and quiet and beach.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like when you want to take your kid to the beach, you live in Marina Del Rey, when you're like, hey, let's all go split a Domino's pizza and go out drinking. That's when you live in Echo Park.
So listen to that for the neighborhoods. And then in terms of just, you know, networking with writers and directors, you know, pretty much everyone you meet in LA is probably a writer and a director, at least aspiring in some way. So, I don't know, just talk to people. It's hard to, you know, when Ulrich from Making Movies is Hard, you know, they're based in San Francisco, but he was here in LA and he met with us at the coffee shop and we knew like five random people at the coffee shop. It's like, it's hard to realize like how easy it is to meet film people in LA until you've been in LA for a few weeks. So I'm not saying it's easy to make friends in LA because I find it actually very difficult because everyone's in their cars and driving. But if you, you know, hang out on sets and comedy schools and all that stuff, you'll meet writers and directors very quickly. I actually think it's easier to find writers and directors than it is to find art department people.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Let me ask you, Oren, because I realized every once in a while, like Chrissy and I will have people over. We'll do like a freelance Friday sort of thing, like a little bit of like an impromptu mixer for our freelancing friends. And I realized, I looked around the room and I was like, oh, all of these people are like writer directors. Like most of the people we associate with are writers and directors, right? And I was like, it used to be that I would know a ton of performers. And I miss associating with actors. Like it's also really fun to like know them and to know their side of the world and to cast them in things, you know? So I want to start associating with other parts of the industry more actively. Do you have any advice for me? How do I hang out with more actors?
Well, I think I came by your party, and there were some DPs and producers that I saw there.
Sure, that's true.
Even a sound person or two. Mm-hmm. So I think you have the crew kind of worked out. I have the same thing with actors. I used to be, when I was much younger and first moved to LA, like, and I wanted to make a short film or a test video or whatever, I would literally just be like, hey, can someone come stand in front of my camera? And there would be like 10 people around that would do it. And nowadays when I'm trying to do, like I just did a test for this Comcast job and I literally had to like call people and ask for favors and book people and schedule stuff and get actors to come to my house. And it was like a lot of work and they were like doing me a favor, you know? Even my wife was like doing me a favor and she lives here, to be in this video. So yeah, I think, I don't know that I'm just thinking out loud here, but acting is really hard to sustain because you are waiting for other people to hire you.
Sure.
Almost always.
Yeah.
And so a lot of actors, they either get a big break and make a lot of money and get on a big TV show, or they start diversifying and become producers or writers or, you know, whatever else they want to do. They start become directing their own stuff. And so I think at our age, like a lot of the people that we moved here and built our network out here with actors have either left
LA. They've either gone home or now they're producers.
Or changed careers. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Or have become really successful and aren't coming to Freelance Fridays.
All right.
Cool.
Final question came in right under the wire. My boy Gary, he was an AC on a series I just did. Started listening to the podcast. Thanks, buddy. He has a question about, he's got a friend who's a great DP. And he wants to know, when is the right time for a DP to get an agent? And how does it help you out, basically? And also, do you need a bunch of big, notable projects before you should go talk to an agent? Which is a great question.
Yeah.
And
a great question, which I think we should say we're not like the most qualified to answer.
That's
because
true,
we
yeah.
are not DPs with agents, but we know a lot of DPs with agents.
Correct.
So we will do our best.
Yeah. I think I'm really racking my brain because I can think of a handful of DPs who have agents and have done big things. And then I can think of a lot of DPs that don't have an agent and have done, who work plenty.
Well, let me ask you this, Matt. Mm-hmm. Have you ever hired a DP through an agency? Like called an agency, said, hey, we need a DP that does cars or whatever.
I absolutely have not. However, I think that that speaks more to my level of, like, I think once you're into like studio world a little bit more, I think that that becomes a bigger conversation. I think it's.
But I, you know, we know a few DPs between the two of us that have shot some bigger studio films, right?
Certainly. But I think that it's, I think when you, as a director, when you book your studio film, like, even if you're like, yo, 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 this person is incredible, trust me, unless the person you're talking about is Rachel Morrison and you guys have shot a couple movies together or something like that, they, you have to do due diligence and look at other people and talk to other people. You
right.
know what I mean?
For, yeah, for sure you meet a few DPs. I don't know if that, how much that has to do with them being having an agent, but Rachel Morrison, who shot Black Panther and Mudbound and Fruitvale Station and Sound of My Voice, like, there's no way that she had the meeting on Black Panther without the director, Ryan Coogler, having... It's
right.
not like he called up William Morris or whatever and said, I need a DP that would be good for this, and they recommended her.
Yeah, yeah, he directed Fruitvale Station. But the, so that's a great example of, like, I think, like... And I think Rian Johnson's DP, who did the latest Star Wars, I think they went to school together, but they had all shot a couple things together first. So I think that... I would definitely imagine a circumstance where I love a DP, but they haven't done a Fruitvale Station or a Brick, where it would be a lot harder to get sign-off. And that's when I think your William Morrises step in and are like, hey, what about these people?
Yeah, but they wouldn't
yeah.
be with William Morris. Oh, right, right. Yeah, I have hired DPs. I have hired DPs through agencies before, and it's very much for specific things. Like, I've not a project I did, but the company I work with, they were just looking for a DP that had a lot of toys on their reel and knew how to mm-hmm. light toys. I've done car stuff where they wanted a DP that had a ton of cars on their reel, and none of the DPs I usually worked with had enough slick-looking car stuff, so we went to an agency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what's interesting is the... below the line agents, they call them, right? The ones that represent DPs and production designers and editors and stuff. Those agencies aren't always like the CAAs and the William Morrises, like ICM
right.
and Gersh and Paradigm. There's other agencies that are have a really strong reputation in representing those types of positions. But it is kind of the middle class of DPs, right? Like the non super famous DPs might have an agent that is getting them work when a producer calls up this agent and is looking for a good DP. But yeah, I think like everything, probably 90% of the work any DP gets is from previous relationships.
From a relationship, yeah.
They have. And we
yeah.
just hired, you know, John, who we'd both worked with on this last campaign, and he has an agent. And we went through the agent to negotiate his rate, I think, but we mm-hmm. didn't hire him because he had an agent.
Right, right. Yeah, and even as you were talking about the scenario of like, oh, I need a DP who specializes in something, immediately I started thinking of all of the DPs I know who have done those sorts of spots before.
Right. And yeah. the other DP I work with all the time, Jess, like I'll email him. I'll be like, hey, send me dog stuff. Hey, send me miniatures. Send me time lapse. Like, mm-hmm. because when I'm putting the crew together, I need to show people that the DP I'm hiring has done this stuff before.
Right, right. But that's more about you selling him upstream, more for their confidence. Like, how often do you feel like on a job you have to get approvals on a DP?
Well, I work with a lot of the same DPs a lot. So most jobs, there's a history there with the producers and everything. Mm-hmm. But if it was a new producer, I feel like I am more excited about the DP or the production designer or the costume designer than other people. Like a lot of, you know, Bramley, who's been on our podcast before, whenever she's on a job with me, I'll be like, hey, we got the costume designer from, she's doing this show on Nickelodeon right now and this show on Netflix, and she's going to do our commercial. You know, I'm like using that cachet as like a selling point to get people excited about what we're working on. Very rare. There's just really specific things, like cars very specifically need to be shot in a certain way, because people think it's really easy to shoot cars, but they're really gigantic mirrors. Mm-hmm. So everything you put around the car makes a giant difference, right?
And also, car brands have a ton of specifications on the manner in which you should shoot a car. So like what height, what angle, what lens you're using in certain circumstances.
Yeah, what like angle the logos are. And they'll give you a special car that maybe doesn't have like a VIN number like in the dashboard or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of times, like, they don't have rear view mirrors because those typically are ugly.
Yeah. I am on the, I did Buick and Ford just recently. And you get like a big packet of like, don't do this, do this.
On all My favorite is how a lot of cars look sleek and fast and powerful from certain angles and kind of fat and squat from other angles.
Yeah. Yeah, or they want to imply a certain size, even like, oh, we don't want this to feel like it's bigger than it actually is because we're trying to market how sleek and small it is or how it's compact or whatever, you know. Anyway, so Gary, good questions. You know, I think the ultimate answer is that this DP, unfortunately, kind of needs to just hustle and like build relationships with directors who are going to get super famous and then move along with them. That's kind of the best advice is go to school with Ryan Coogler. But
one other thing Gary says, though, is it naive to think that an agent would even look at your work if you don't have very known projects under your belt? And the answer to that is absolutely no. If you have an amazing looking reel of like all commercials in Spain or something that no one has ever seen or heard of, that's great. If you have beautiful looking shorts, but you know, it's a reel. Give us 2 or 3 minutes of amazing shots.
I will say
a celebrity or two would be nice.
The flip side of that though is that you know, there's only a handful of name brand DPs that are big time, and so there's a ton of DPs out there that have shot movies that you have heard of and like, and you're up against them. So that is the tricky part, is an agent can only sell you so well. And, you know, you are going to be up against the person who shot Baywatch or Neighbors 2 or whatever. And like those, that's not Roger Deakins, but your competition is still going to have some cool looking recognizable stuff on their reel. So that kind of helps determine how helpful they're going to be able to be. So I think that maybe aiming for commercials or music videos or things that can like create looks that pop more, that are a little more eye catching rather than like just shooting, you know, comedies where people are talking to each other. It's a lot harder to like grab someone's attention, even with like a Will Ferrell movie or something.
Right. Yeah. I have a lot of tips on DP reels, but we'll save those for a different episode. One last thing is the DP I just worked with. He had just switched agencies, and he said that with his first agency, he probably like 5% of his work came through that agency, and he had maybe like 3 or 4 meetings a year from them. And his new agency, he just likes way better. And has like 2 or 3 meetings like a month, and he is getting like a job every month or two through the agency. So
the agency,
I think,
how long has he been with the agency?
The new agency? Mm-hmm. I think like 6 months or something.
Okay. Yeah. Cause there is a little bit of a honeymoon period where like they're really hot on you and they're sending you out a bunch, and then like things kind of cool off and mellow out a little bit. And that to me is always the indicator of how much work you're really going to be getting from a new part of your team.
Yeah.
So it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, well, good luck with the agents.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. I hope you like your new job, buddy. And thanks for writing in. If you want to write in, if you have a question, you can always tweet at us. Or the best way to do it so that we don't lose track is to email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com or our very favorite, drop us a voicemail like Elisa did. You can give us a call at 2626-SHOOT-1. That's 2626-SHOOT-1. The voicemails are really cool. I think it kind of gives people a better perspective of what you're out there looking for, and it kind of helps you connect with the community a little bit more. So we love all questions, but email and the voicemail are the way to go.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up our episode, let's do our final segment.
Unpaid endorsements.
All right. I finally have a good one. I can't believe it's taken me weeks to bring this up. Oren, did you see the video on YouTube of the short film Tank?
Tank?
Tank. T-A-N-K. Tank.
No.
So it is a very cool short film that's done in the style of like vector graphics, kind of like old school arcade
games.
Oh,
yes, I did see it.
Right, yeah. So it's like you'll, as soon as you see an image, you'll be like, oh, right, those sorts of games. So there's like, there was an old Star Wars game. I think the old Tron game is like this as well, where it's like shapes created out of like vector graphics. So just kind of
lines.
Lines and dots, basically. Yeah, that kind of glow. And they have this really cool old-fashioned sort of feel to them. And the short is very good, but the BTS, which kind of functions as like a VFX tutorial piece as well, is a work of art unto itself that I really enjoyed and have watched a couple times. The film is by Stu Mockwitz. The BTS video, I cannot recommend it enough. I think it just is a really wonderful insight into the creative process as informed by VFX. And it's just a different direction and a different creative process, but still totally relatable. I think there are a lot of like cool small tricks and tips that you can take from him. And then also just on a macro level, just seeing a person's approach that's so fundamentally different than mine, but still relatable, I think is awesome. So that's my endorsement.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I fully support your endorsement for once.
Yeah, that's why I was like, oh man, I got to get this in before Oren gets there. Yeah.
So. Well, I have a weird endorsement. So there's this movie out in theaters now called Hereditary with Toni Collette. It's like a horror film. Yes, check out the trailer. I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of it. I have not seen the movie. I'm not endorsing the movie.
It looks very scary.
The visuals in the trailer were so ridiculous that I was like, who directed this movie? And it's this guy named Ari Aster, A-R-I-A-S-T-E-R. I didn't really know anything about him, but I just looked for to see if he had a website. And he does. It's ari-aster.squarespace.com. Great URL. And he has a trailer for Hereditary, and he has 7 short films on there that he made.
Oh.
And they are bonkers. One of them I had actually seen before. It's called Basically, and it's with Rachel Brosnahan. And it's like, if you didn't know her before, she was, well, now she's the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, but she was on House of Cards as the prostitute before. But she is like, if you had no idea who she was and you saw the short, you'd be like, I must cast this woman. It's like probably one of the best acting roles I've ever seen. And it's literally just her talking to camera about her life. It's called Basically, but it around her house. But he made this other short film called The Strange Thing About the Johnsons. It's one of the most like fucked up shorts I've seen ever. It's really uncomfortable. But the way that he uses the camera to tell the story and move you around the scene is really, really impressive. You know, when you're like, oh, you know what would be cool is if we do this shot where this character like picks up this box and then carries it over here and we follow the box with the camera and then we realize we're in a different room. Like, all those ideas you have, and then you're on set and you're like, ah, shit, this will never work.
Just like a coverage. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just shoot a wide and then a close up. He pulls them off in like the most insane ways. He has another short called Munchausen that's like, has no dialogue, about this mom that's like upset that her son's going off to college. And it's long. I think it's like 5 minutes or something. It's long for film. Oh, no, it's 16 minutes. It's long for a film with no dialogue. But the shot transitions are just mind-blowing. Like, I would watch and I'd rewind it and I'd be like, wait, how did we get from this location to this location? I never saw a cut, but we're in the house. Now we're in a college. And just really quite impressive stuff. So, I don't know. I spent a whole, you know, like, hour on this guy's website just watching all his shorts.
Oh, man. Well, I can't wait.
Ari-aster.squarespace.com. I'm curious what you think, Matt. I have a feeling you will not like him anymore because you don't like people that milk their tools that much sometimes.
I don't know if that's true. I was more nervous that I'm too scared.
Oh, no, I don't think you'll be scared. But we'll, you know, see. But it's not something that you watch for 10 seconds. Like, you need to invest some time in this website.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sounds great.
Check
awesome.
It out. I'm sure his career needs zero help right now, but
yeah, he's doing okay.
It's nice to catch these people's websites before they like blow up, you know, and they delete all their like old stuff.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I can't wait to check it out. We'll have a link to all of that stuff in the show notes. And you can follow us on all of the social media platforms at this point at Just Shoot It Pod. We're really working on our Instagram game, our Twitter game, Facebook, trying to offer a little bit of something different in each of those places. So check them all out. Thanks for listening, everyone. You can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And me at Smitey Pileg. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you can. It really helps the podcast, helps people find us. And this episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe. And our producer is Madeline Rosewatt. She's been here with us this whole time. Silently.
She's so bored. Thanks, Madeline. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.